So the Bardo of Life, or the Birthplace Bardo. So this life itself is regarded as an in-between, a Bardo. It's between birth and death, and this therefore is regarded, this space, as containing a tremendous opportunity, tremendous possibility. It's an incredible space that we actually occupy. This is always dwelt on in all traditions, that the human life is extraordinarily precious, and human consciousness is remarkable. Yes, we can rehearse again and again how bad human beings are, but we're also capable of incredible good because we've got this remarkable consciousness that can practice ethics, that can have a vision of what is possible and can transform even unto enlightenment itself. So the verse goes, "O now when the bardo of life upon me is dawning." So reflecting on this, it means that the bardo of life upon me is dawning is waking up. It's the time when you actually wake up to the tremendous possibility that this life offers. And obviously we need to keep waking up to that on a regular basis, every day, every moment. The precious human life is often described as the kshana in Sanskrit. I don't know what the Tibetan is, which also means the moment. This is the moment. This life is the moment. This is the time. This is the opportunity. This moment, this time. As the great Dogen says, the great Zen master, you are only alive right now. So don't waste time. This moment can come to an end at any moment. So don't waste time in futile pursuits, arguing and plotting the downfall of your enemies, and so on and so forth. If you want to read one of the best exhortations, I mean, Dogen is brilliant in the Primer of Soto Zen on the importance of meditating on impermanence and the ever-presence of death. But another wonderful text is a text called Death and the Bodhisattva Trainings by the great 13th Dalai Lama, the previous Dalai Lama, which is in that book by Glenn Mullin, Death and Dying, the Tibetan Tradition, which Bhante said he thought ought to be studied on ordination retreats. I don't think it's ever been. Death and Dying, the Tibetan Tradition, Glenn Mullin, Death and the Bodhisattva Trainings. It's a sermon that he gave at the great prayer festival in Lhasa. Very, very wonderful text. So we need to really wake up to our precious opportunity. Abandoning idleness, there being no idleness in a devotee's life. So a devotee, I don't know what the original is here. I mean, devotee, it could be bhakta, someone with devotion who has bhakti. It could be disciple, shishya. That would be another possibility, because a disciple is also a devotee. A devotee, a disciple of Padmasambhava, has no time for idleness, and it needs to be abandoned completely. Idleness here meaning making no effort to grow, to develop. So we're talking here about rousing energy, rousing interest. This is Dogen's great point about the importance of meditating on death regularly. He says, because that is the way you generate desire, the desire for the way. He said, that's the only thing between you and gaining enlightenment, developing desire for the way. He gives the example, if somebody wants to get to know a beautiful woman, if they want to steal a priceless jewel, they make a lot of effort to put a lot of skill and ingenuity into planning for it. So in the same way, all you need is the desire for enlightenment, and you generate that through meditating on impermanence and meditating on the ever-present possibility of death, thus Dogen. And yes, there's only this time and this moment to practice. So if we're getting caught in negative emotion, distraction, blame, whatever it might be, well, just ask yourself, you know, hang on, how long have I got? You know, supposing I die in this moment. I remember a solitary where I was doing meditating quite a lot on the mind training verses, and particularly the death meditation. And as often happens on solitary retreats, I have arguments with people who aren't there, you know, going for a walk and suddenly finding I'm sort of shouting. And then, you know, you see a walker coming in the distance, I have to start having a coughing fit. And terrible, isn't it? What a giveaway. But then one day I thought, well, supposing you died having an argument with somebody who's not there. I mean, what then? What's your rebirth? So, yes, just keep coming back to the moment. And this is the only moment in which to practice. Entering into the reality undistractedly. So we need to wake up without distraction to our actual existential situation, especially the unknown time of death. Life is short and the objects of knowledge are many, says the great Atisha. So be like the hunksa, the goose or the swan who can extract the milk of goodness from life. Life is short and the objects of knowledge are many. This phrase, entering into the reality undistractedly, did actually become, I was doing the root verses meditation on a solitary quite a long time ago, back at the old Vajrakuta caravan, and this phrase became quite sort of spontaneously, you know, when I was doing that thing of getting distracted on walks, I kept hearing this phrase, entering into the reality undistractedly, just to keep coming back to what was happening in the moment. You know, and this can be the way it works, I think, with meditation on a text. You can just end up with a phrase or a word that brings you back to what you're supposed to be doing. Jodi Parla probably knows all about this, but I was looking up what they call Lectio Divina, the reading the divine word, which is a very traditional Christian monastic practice where you study and read, you know, the Bible, obviously, or other works. But eventually it gets boiled down to a single phrase or to a single word which you constantly meditate on. So I think this is the value of learning things by heart. They can become like precepts, essential precepts to bring you back to what you're supposed to be doing. Going for refuge, developing skillful states. And a guru, of course, and these are the words of a guru. A guru is, of course, someone who always brings you back to entering into reality undistractedly. You know, I've had a few experiences with the Padmasambhava Sadhana. I remember one where I was really spacing out doing the sadhana, and suddenly this voice said, "Wake up!" really, really loudly. It was a real shock, you know, and, you know, I woke up. So this is what we need to do. We need to internalize the teacher in this way. This is what the inner teacher really is, because they keep bringing you back to what is important, to what is essential. Entering into the reality undistractedly, listening, reflecting, and meditating. So here we have the three kinds of prajna described as the path. This is actually describing the whole of the path. You know, you can look at the path entirely in terms of the development of wisdom. I personally think we need to make a lot more of the three kinds of wisdom. I think wisdom is much more important than insight. And the three levels of wisdom, you can associate them with all the other stages of the path: morality, meditation, wisdom, and so on and so forth. our aim in life is to develop wisdom, a very rounded wisdom, taking into account, if you like, everything, rather than a very narrow kind of seeing, if you like. We want a rounded wisdom. So first of all, there's listening, which is Shrutamaya Prajna, the wisdom that comes from hearing. It's very, very important, this wisdom. It's not just knowing the words. The word Shruta in Sanskrit means that you regard who's speaking as an authority. You get this distinction in Indian tradition between Shruta and Shastra. Shruta means it comes from a divine source. Shastra means it's commentarial. So Shruta means you regard the Buddha as your teacher. You regard the lineage as having a weight of authority for you. Authority in the best sense, not, you know, you must not do this and that sort of thing. Because, why? Because you have faith. Because you have Shraddha. Because from experience you know that this has a weight for you. It has a, if you like, almost a holiness to it. So you're going to take it very seriously. You're going to be very open to it. Remember that the early disciples of the Buddha, well, we chant it every morning, don't we? The Savaka Sangho, the community of hearers, of listeners. I noticed that in his last essays, Bhante didn't use the word Hinayana or Theravada. He used the word Shravakayana. Shravakayana. That's, if you like, the hearers of the yana of the hearers who are receptive to the fundamental teachings of the Buddha. We regard the Guru, we regard the Buddha as the real teacher, and we take in that teaching fully. And of course, you can go straight to reality with Shrutamaya Prajna. It's not necessarily a preliminary wisdom. You know, there's plenty of stories in the Pali Canon and in other places where the word of the teacher explodes into an experience for the disciple. It's kind of unmediated, direct seeing of the way things are through the communication of the teacher. Then there's, you know, but at first, probably for us, we just need to really take in what the Buddha says. We need to take in the basic teachings and have in our heart, learn by heart, a few phrases, a few teachings, which we love, which we then turn over regularly in our mind. So this is Chintamaya Prajna, the wisdom that comes through, well, it's not more than reflecting, it's intensely pondering upon. I mean, chinta is thought, it's wishing, it's intently meditating on and turning over in your mind, not just with your mind, but with your heart as well, and allowing it to affect you, to change you. You're sort of seeding your consciousness with the holy Dharma over and over again. You're bringing it down into the depths of your heart. So you make it more and more of a living experience. There's that wonderful thing that the great cultural critic George Steiner once said on Desert Island Discs, I think, of all places, where he was talking about his education in the old French lycée tradition, where you had to memorize under sort of pain of punishment, I think, but you had to, I'm not suggesting we do anything like that, you had to memorize all the classics, Latin, Greek, French, everything. And he said, actually, it did him a lot of good, because he said it you start to internalize wisdom. And he said, what it gives you is ballast for the storms of life. You know, ships have ballast so that they don't get blown around. And he sort of wondered about the effect on modern life of not giving people wisdom, if you like, that they can constantly reflect on and meditate on, that they're just going to be blown about by all sorts of things. And there's no ballast, no wisdom internalized. You know, we learn wisdom from people. We learn wisdom from great people. You know, it just doesn't come out of empty space. So it's good, I think, to internalize and reflect upon. You know, it doesn't have to be a lot, just a few phrases, used to, you know, the words of the Buddha. And then bhavanamaya prajna, the wisdom, is usually said meditating, because bhavana is meditation. But I like Herbert Gunter's rendering. He says it's the wisdom of making it a living experience, making it a living experience. So you want that, if you like, that journey from hearing through reflecting to turn into actual experience in all areas of life. Yes, in meditation, but actually everywhere. So the whole of your life is transformed by the word of the Buddha, by the word of the guru, by the words of the masters. You know, and it could be any set. It's good to have a set. I've been saying in recent years that I feel I would have achieved something in this life if I made verses 1 to 6 of the Dhammapada an actual living experience. If I could do that, that would be a real achievement. You know, verses 1 to 6. Go and look them up if you want to know what they are. But yes, I tend to think that that is where all the essential wisdom is. It could be the four thoughts that turn the mind to the Dharma, the mind turning reflections. It could indeed be these root verses that you make into a living experience. And of course, all in the context of devotion, faith, ethics, meditation, going for refuge, service of the Dharma, spiritual friendship, all that. And, you know, we really want to reach the point which Yeshe Tsogyal, the great disciple of Guru Rinpoche, says, where the whole of her experience, the whole of life, rises up as the guru, as the teacher. Teachings, in other words, are just coming from everywhere. Everything is the teacher. It's like Milarepa and his pot, which he worships when it breaks. Do you remember that very famous story? His only possession, his pot breaks. So he worships it as his guru. And you know the guru devotion that Milarepa had for Marpa. But this humble, broken pot becomes his guru because it teaches him attachment. He's attached even to this pot. Everything is impermanent, and you can't even be attached to just one thing. That goes. Because he's been really meditating on the teachings that he's been given. So he turns even that pot into a teacher. And I don't know if you remember that I was rereading Bhante's earlier life, that when he read that story, he wept. He was so moved by the story when he first encountered it. And I think he mentioned that story of him being so moved by that pot to Paramata just a few days before he died. And Paramata, looking back, realized that Bhante was sort of trying to tell him something. And then carrying on to the path, knowledge of the true nature of appearances and of mind, may the Trikaya be realized. So the path begins with vision, the darshana marga, the path of vision. Here, the vision is described in terms of the true nature of appearances and of mind. In other words, seeing the impermanence, insubstantiality, the emptiness, and indeed, this is a Dzogchen text, the luminosity of everything. You're waking up that all appearances are maya. You're entering the maya way, as it's described in the Manjugosha Stuti Sadhana. Everything appears, it's vivid, it's real, but it's insubstantial. And our mind is exactly the same. Our mind is also empty and luminous. Inside and outside, there is just this wonderful play of appearance and emptiness. Maya in Buddhism is very different, very important to understand this, from Maya in Hinduism, particularly Vedanta. Maya in Hinduism, as far as I can tell, means that it's not really happening. You think you're seeing caste discrimination and people being treated as untouchables, but that's an error on your part and everybody else's. That's not the reality. The reality is the non-dual Brahman. Buddhism doesn't say that. They have an absolute unity of the absolute and relative truth. Maya is just another way of describing Pratitya Samuppada, and karma and its effects doesn't still obtains. And yes, if people are treating each other very, very badly in that way, that is not a delusion. That's really happening. But yes, everything is conditioned co-production. Everything is Maya. But the path, you could say, really begins when we have a glimpse of the ever-changingness of everything. You could say it's, to keep it, it might not be at this exalted level of the Maya way, but certainly waking up to the impermanence of everything. Perhaps we also need to see this happening more positively. I've been recalling Bhante at the end of one of his 15 points. Do you remember those for old and new order members? Really good set of precepts, actually. In one of them, he says that if you do these 15 points, you'll experience your Buddhist life, as the Buddha says, and I've never tracked down the Pali source for this, as a living thing, a growing thing. That's actually the experience of insubstantiality and the true nature of appearances of mind. Experiencing your Dharma life as a living thing, as a growing thing, the proverbial lotus unfolding. I think this is really important. I think Bhante's gift to us, one of his great gifts, is the so-called spiral path and all these organic symbols of for the spiritual life. That's actually the experience of shunyata. That's the experience of ever-changingness, but it's entirely positive. You know, just looking back and comparing how you are now with how you were back then and seeing the change, that's an insight into shunyata. Seeing that growth and change. It's not some sort of, you know, sense of a kind of static space. It's this sense of our of all of life being a living thing, a growing thing. So you could say if we have this sort of vision or insight, this sort of feeling even, we're stepping onto the path. The path, in a sense, starts at the top. And then there's the path of transformation. Could you flip the page over, please, for the next thing? So, may the tree kaya be realized. So, according to the root verses, our goal, having treading this path of ever-changingness, insubstantiality, that means that we can achieve total and complete transformation, realizing the tree kaya in our life, our body being transformed into the nirmanakaya, the appearance body, our speech being transformed into the sambhogakaya, the enjoyment body, and our mind becoming transformed into the Dharmakaya, the body of reality. In other words, what we're aiming for is the total transformation of our psychophysical continuum into Buddhahood itself. It's a very, very concrete image of Buddhahood. I remember being on a seminar with Bhante where he talked about the critique of the different yanas to one another. So he said, well, the classic critique of the Mahayana of the Hinayana is that it's not for all sentient beings, so it's not for Buddhahood. But the critique of the Vajrayana to the Mahayana is the realization is only mental. It needs to involve the transformation of the total being into Buddhahood. And he said there is something in it. There is something in it. Whether or not you relate to it in a sectarian way, I don't think you need to do that. I think it's more the point he was trying to draw out, that you have to realise Buddhahood totally. Sadhana is actually a meditation on Trikaya. So we're practicing this in our sadhanas. So the blue sky at the beginning of the practice, actually what we're opening up to is the Dharmakaya. Buddhahood beyond any definition, beyond any language. The blue sky is a symbol of that. What you're trying to get in touch with is that profound mystery of the perfect ones, that vast, open, non-dimension. This is why the element practice is so important as a preparation for sadhana, that you're letting go into that space. So you really are ideally starting at the top when you do a sadhana. In the sadhana we're doing, it actually specifies that the clear blue sky is the immaculate Dharma Dhatu. Some would say that is the same as the Dharmakaya. Sometimes it actually says at the beginning of a sadhana that you're as it were in the Dharmakaya imaginatively. And it's inconceivable, it's beyond subject, object, time, place, all that. It's very, very good, I think, to, if you can, to for a while, to give up any sense of dimension. You know, at the end of the six element practice, you're trying to let go into over the years, Bhante sort of changed the way he talked about the last stages of the element practice, and in the end he wouldn't say anything about it, quite deliberately, I think, that you really have to let go of all ideas, you know, forget all ideas entirely. You've got into the momentum of giving up, of being non-identified, and you're trying then to really let go into something completely open. And you've got no fixed position, no point of view, no sort of place in space. That's what you're looking for. And it sometimes he has said as well that if you want to have, as it were, a sense of yourself in a sadhana, imagine it that you're just a sort of quivering mass of energy. It's not you in the ordinary sense anymore. So it's worth sort of playing with that a bit when you approach sadhana. But then that's not the last word, because there's an appearance. It's not a stepping down away. This is quite important. Sometimes you can have the idea, oh, Dharmakaya must be the highest and everything else is the lowest. That is actually a wrong view of the way these things are. It's not like that at all, because I was saying last night, according to this tradition, the Dharmakaya is naturally expressive. Reality is naturally outpouring and communicating. So it expresses, in the sense of this retreat, its expression, the expression of primordial purity, if you like, is in the form of this glorious teacher, Guru Padmasambhava. Incredibly beautiful. That's the sort of most refined approach in this case that you could have to that vast space. So the visualized form symbolizes the Sambhogakaya, as well as the mantra and so on. And of course it must be as beautiful as possible, and fascinating and attractive, that delights us. Bhante has talked about this. He was on one occasion, he was, I hope I'm not going to confuse you now because it's a slightly different sphere of discourse, but he was asked why metta-bhavana is so important before visualization. Because in the early days, when I was around, six element practice wasn't mentioned so much. It was metta that was the big thing. Before sadhana, and Ratnagula asked him this very good question: why is metta so important. He said, well, metta enables you to enter, according to the Buddha, a formless liberation called the beautiful. Through metta bhavana, you're seeing everybody as beautiful. And then at the end of the metta, you sort of let go of specific people and you just say, it is beautiful. It is beautiful. Subhani, subhani. And you enter this formless beauty. He said, it doesn't have a colour, it doesn't have a shape, doesn't have a name, but you know it is absolutely beautiful. The Buddha or Bodhisattva takes form, sort of condenses out of that. And it is incredibly important to see the Buddha or Bodhisattva as beautiful, especially in the early days of visualization practice. I mean, the early days seem to be lasting a very long time for me, over 40 years now. But that's okay. So because the beauty will hold you there. The beauty will hold you there. So this is really, really important. Making space for the beautiful in our lives generally, actually, but especially in our sadhanas. You know, you don't do them because they're good to do and they're very worthy. They must absolutely captivate you and really grab you so that you stay with them and have tremendous sort of interest in them, and desire and longing for them. Tremendously important. Sambhoga, of course, means mutual enjoyment. So you're trying to get to a level in this stage of the visualization practice where there's this kind of communication of mutual bliss, mutual pleasure in one another. Obviously we're at a lower level to the Buddha or Bodhisattva, so we're taking, but we need to take pleasure. And of course it's also said they take pleasure in us. In the Manjugosha Stuti Sadhana, it says that Manjugosha is well pleased to be visualized. He's well pleased that you're there, but they're all well pleased. I know sometimes people get into a bit of a pickle about Padmasambhava's face. Is he being disapproving? And I remember Visantra asking Bhante about this on a seminar years ago, saying that, you know, that he can feel disapproved of by Padmasambhava. And Bhante was really puzzled. Disapproved of? How is that possible? Padmasambhava is full of compassion and love. And Visantra said it was a bit of a shock because he'd sort of realised he'd projected Jehovah onto Padmasambhava. And Bhante said, look, if you're having trouble with the frowny bit, just see him as somebody just incredibly, ecstatically loving. You know, his face is animated with love and delight. So, you know, don't feel disapproved of by Padmasambhava. It's a big mistake. You know, he loves you like a father and a mother, the best father that we never had and the best mother that we never had. There's this absolute love for you. So the visualized figure is the Sambhogakaya, but then the Nirmanakaya is in the practice as well. The hum is said to symbolize sometimes the Dharmakaya, sometimes the Nirmanakaya, but when it's in the heart, when it's entered into you, that means everything has come into emanation, the emanated body, you know, the full realization of Buddhahood in your experience. That's what it symbolizes. And I know we're not there at that level most of the time, but that's the symbolism of a practice like this. In fact, it's the Swabhavakaya, it's the union of all the kayas, you know, when it, you know, by the conclusion of the practice. But it's quite an inspiring way to think of sadhana, I think, as the transformation of body, speech and mind. You know, we get onto the path with this sense of the fluid nature, the ever-changing nature of everything. We're alive to the fact that this is a precious opportunity. We enter into this maya-like way, and when we meditate on our chosen Buddha or Bodhisattva, we're using the fact that everything is fluid to transform body, speech and mind into the full display of Buddhahood itself. Could you flick it over again? Just another point to confuse you with. This is really for the sake of completion. Dzogchen Atta Yoga tradition speak about, if you like, the essential nature of everything. And they relate it to the tree kaya. So they say the essence of everything is emptiness, which is equivalent to the Dharmakaya. Its nature is luminosity, which is equivalent to the Sambhogakaya. And its energy is compassion, which is the Nirmanakaya. So what I think is really interesting about this sort of vision of emptiness, it's so obviously not nihilistic. And that's why it's so important that there's a quality to the insubstantiality and emptiness of everything, which is luminous and brilliant, communicative, and it has this quality of energy, which is compassionate activity and love. It's not just about, you know, dwelling on the voidness of everything. And another thing to confuse you as well, the bardos of death, reality, dharmata, and rebirth correspond to the tree kaya. The moment of death, you have the experience, it's said, of the dharmakaya, the expression of all those deities is said to be Sambhogakaya, and taking rebirth it's more they can be transformed into these things, transformed into Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya. So here you can see how your sadhana is a preparation for the experience of death, reality, and rebirth. You could even sort of think that when you're meditating, you're sort of going on that journey. In the first stage of visualization, you're opening up to the clear light of reality with the blue sky. You're then meditating, getting used to meditating on the bodhisattvas, the expressions of awareness, and then the conclusion of the practice and the emergence into the world is, as it were, being reborn. At the end of our practice, we get up, reborn, transformed, carrying all that experience of and all that richness of, you know, from our sadhana into everyday life.
Question.
Yeah.
What's the difference, the dharmata, obviously dharmakaya, yesterday, the dharmata.
Dharmata is rather like dharma dhatu and dharmakaya. They have...
The same or...?
Kind of more or less. They're emphasising slightly different things.
Like what?
Well, Dharmakaya, in a way, is relating reality to the body of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Dharma Dhatu is relating it to the whole of existence.
Mm-hmm.
Dharmata, I think what Dharmata is just trying to get at is simply to the nature of things.
Mm-hmm.
Literally means the dharmaness of everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're more or less synonymous at that level. And then finally, once that the human form has been attained, may there be no time or opportunity in which to idle it away. So no time to idle it away, so we don't waste time. You know, we keep up a continual awareness of the best use of our time, and I don't mean running around doing lots and lots of worthy things. The right thing to do with your time might be sitting absolutely still, but awareness of time and opportunity, good conditions, making sure you're in the best possible conditions to support your practice and creating the best possible conditions. So there we are. The bardo of life. Oh, now, when the bardo of life upon me is dawning, abandoning idleness, there being no idleness in a devotee's life, entering into the reality undistractedly, listening, reflecting, and meditating, carrying on to the path knowledge of the true nature of appearances and of mind, may the tree kaya be realized. Once that the human form has been attained, may there be no time or opportunity in which to idle it away. Okay, all know what to do.